This audio recording is copyrighted by AboutFacts.net and its licensors. All rights are reserved.
Today our guest is Mark McCandlish. Mark is a conceptual artist, UFO researcher, and former member of the U.S. Air Force. Hello, Mark. It's nice to have you back.
Hi, Ken. Thank you so much.
Now, there's just so much going on, and it's hard to decide on a starting point. Who would you say is one of the most knowledgeable people that you have met in the UFO field?
Well, in the UFO field, the researchers that I've corresponded with, I've only met a handful of them directly, but I would say some of the more intellectual people that I've met that actually delve into the science behind UFOs would probably be some of the scientists. And although I don't think they would characterize themselves as being ufologists or UFO researchers, they're certainly interested, many of them on a personal level, in the technology that would go into something like this. And the individuals that I've corresponded with in that regard are people like Hal Puthoff or Thomas Vallone. I met another gentleman. I'm trying to remember his name now. It's a scientist who wrote a book. I think it was about the anti-gravity Air Force. I'm trying to remember his name. Slips my mind at the moment. But those are some of the more intellectual, the more intelligent people that I've met or at least corresponded with.
Well, it seems to me that certain people are only there for disinformation purposes. Do you agree, and have you ever met any of these people? And I'm not looking for any names or anything.
Well, you know, there are a few people out there that that claim has been made about. The thing that makes disinformation work, and you probably know this yourself, is that the best way to propagate a lie or to spread a lie is to sort of blend it in with certain elements of truth, things that you know to be true, so that everything else about what the whatever the statement may be has the ring of truth itself. And so that's one of the things that you'll find very often in disinformation is that there is certain elements of truth within that. And so that's one of the things that I think you have to look for. I've noticed myself that there are certain individuals whose names keep popping up over and again in regards to things having to do with disinformation. But, you know, it's hard to know unless you're deeply involved in this kind of stuff which parts of it are truthful and which parts are just completely lies. So it's something you have to you eventually figure it out when you are able to sort out what you know to be true and what's false.
Have you ever gone to any forums where it seemed that the people were there only to shoot down other people and shoot down other people that might have some good ideas or information? Because I get complaints about this kind of stuff all the time, you know?
Well, you know, it's kind of like the things that you see in the scientific community itself. Everybody has their pet theory about, you know, what's going on with any given phenomenon. Many people have explanations that they've spent a lot of time, a lot of years developing, and may feel that they can support with the research they've done. And of course, you know, many people they really have kind of an emotional investment in their beliefs, just like many of us have emotional investments in you know, the religion that we follow. And so I think that a lot of times you'll find people that get very upset when they don't hear what they believe to be true. And, you know, I've always tried to remain open. I mean, I've had things that I was skeptical about, particularly the whole UFO contactee, UFO abduction phenomenon, in terms of whether or not I actually believed those things. And, you know, it wasn't until I actually sat down with a number of individuals who claimed to have had these kinds of experiences, and they showed me the scars where implants had been driven into their skull through the roof of their mouth. I mean, it's not everybody that, you know, not every day that you see someone with 2 quarter-inch diameter scars that look like bullet holes in the roof of their mouth. You know, people generally don't go and do that just for the fun of it, you know, just to make their story have the ring of truth. So it's startling moments like that where you wake up and you begin to think, you know, there must be something else going on here.
What do you think of Julian Assange, the director of WikiLeaks?
Well, you know, I think that... In some respects, I mean, he's been characterized in some parts of the media as a socialist and someone who hates America. And, you know, I really couldn't speak to that itself. I don't know if there's any truth to that. But I think that, you know, there's certain aspects of diplomacy that are best kept unstated, especially comments about whether someone has any real regard for the statesmen of another country, or how their thinking might be manipulated to best serve the needs and the interests of the United States government. And I'm sure it's a two-way street. I'm sure that those kinds of things go on both, you know, in the State Departments of other countries as well as our own. But, you know, I keep hearing that he's holding back some information that's distinctly related to the UFO phenomenon, and how much the United States government and military may know about that, whether they're actually in the process of still intercepting unidentified aircraft or one kind of another. The things that I've seen in my experience would certainly suggest that at the very least they're interested in whatever the technology is that these vehicles are making use of, and I've seen quite a bit of evidence that they probably have already figured it out and they're exploiting it themselves. So if there's something in those documents that Julian Assange may have or may yet be you know, holding back as a bargaining chip, you know, I'm sure it's fairly significant.
Well, recently some members of Congress have called for his execution. Do you think that he's done anything that merits execution?
Well, you know, anytime you embarrass government officials to the degree that he has, there's always going to be someone out there that says, you know, this guy is a real threat. He's a real danger to, you know, the peace that we're trying to negotiate with other countries, and revealing what's going on within the back channels of that process can, you know, literally cost people their lives, not just, you know, people who are the victims of terrorist acts and bombings, but people who might be, you know, working for the United States surreptitiously behind the scenes, who's you know, lives and whose families may be put in jeopardy by the disclosure of, you know, the source of any given piece of information. So it's a very dangerous world we live in. I mean, you know, it's easy to understand why some people working within the federal government would call for things like that. But I think that if there's anybody who, you know, ought to be put before a firing squad, it's the soldier or the, you know, the individual who actually downloaded this information and then made it available to Julian Assange. I think that's the person. If you wanted to put your finger on anyone who's a traitor or who has jeopardized many, many other lives, it's the person who actually obtained that information and passed it to WikiLeaks.
Did you see the document that was released from WikiLeaks that states that a Russian admiral reported a large vortex at the Gulf of Aden in the year 2000?
I haven't seen the email. I've been hearing about that. There's a number of kind of back channel sources that I, you know, I really question the validity of, like Sorcha Fall, that talk about these kinds of things, and usually they're couched in the context of a special report that was prepared by the FSB for President Putin. Vladimir Putin reveals that you know, the United States is worried about this vortex that appeared in the Gulf of Aden. But whether or not that's true, whether or not something you can see on Google Earth, and I've looked and I haven't seen any of the things they're talking about. But you know, if there is something going on over there, certainly. I'm sure that the governments of the earth would want to keep it quiet so that people wouldn't panic. But, you know, anything of that nature, you know, I mean, you could have a number of different countries, all of whom have or exploit the HAARP kind of technology, all broadcasting their energy to a fixed location that would then begin to manifest things like that, like a supercell weather system that might produce those kinds of effects. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that unless you're there and can actually witness what's going on, you really have no other choice but to sort of sit back and sort of look with a skeptical eye at these kinds of stories.
Well, supposedly the story states that the vortex that was there in the year 2000 was still there in the year 2008 and started to get larger. And it was said that the U.S. notified the governments of the world, and now the biggest fleet ever established in history from more than 27 nations is sitting there. And the official word was it was to fight the Somali pirates. Do you believe that we would have a fleet that large? A world fleet just to fight, you know, a few Somali pirates?
Well, the Gulf of Aden is a very, very large area. I mean, if you look at the number of square miles that are there, I mean, it's probably the size of Texas. And so the idea that there might be several hundred ships there, you know, it may seem like it's an awful lot of firepower for one small area. But when you spread it out over an area the size of Texas, you're really looking at a screen door when it comes to trying to stop little tiny Zodiac inflatables from, you know, getting from one point to another. In fact, I find it surprising how much of what has happened involving the Somali pirates has been able to be accomplished using inflatables. You know, they sneak up on a boat, a ship in the middle of the night with a lot of guns and take the crew hostage. I mean, seems like all it would really take to stop something like that is to have some hired guns on the deck that were out there with night vision watching the horizon all the time. And, you know.
Well, that's a good point because supposedly a lot of ships do have that. They've hired private security forces because it's against the maritime law to send out an armed merchant ship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a friend who's a former Force Recon Marine who I haven't heard from for about 9 or 10 months who is talking about doing exactly that. So I'm sure that there are probably websites that you can find on the Internet where they solicit that kind of expertise, shall we say.
Right. I mean, you would think, at least I would think, that that would be a much more efficient way of stopping the pirates than sending out all these ships.
Mm-hmm. Well, even just a few shots across the bow of an inflatable will certainly give the person piloting the thing the pause, you know.
Yeah, well, they also have a new weapon. It's a sound device. I don't know if you saw that. It's like a sound cannon where they fire it at the small craft, and it just knocks everybody over. I mean, they can't do anything. The sound is so bad it gets into their head, and they have to retreat, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that comes under the heading of what they would refer to as non-lethal weapons.
Oh, and, absolutely, yeah.
That's one of the things that Colonel John Alexander and my friend Hal Putoff have had some involvement in for a number of years, and it's a great deterrent against acts of piracy on the high seas if you can put together a weapon system that gives you a little bit of a standoff when it comes to people that mean to do you harm, and at the same time preserve their lives and, you know, make them think twice about coming aboard.
Apparently the president has a bunker named 2012 Alice. and he was taken there when a strange wormhole-like light appeared over Norway. It's also said that Putin was taken to his bunker. This was mm-hmm. confirmed by WikiLeaks documents. First, what do you think is going on? And second, do you think it's a little strange that the president's bunker would be named 2012 anything?
Well, you know, there's so much on the internet about, you know, secret bunkers, secret underground bases, and, you know, hidden structures. I mean, this kind of thing goes back to some time before the Second World War. I mean, my dad was stationed at Ramstein Air Base over in West Germany back in the 60s, and not too far from the community of Landstuhl, there was an underground facility, not unlike the NORAD facility near Colorado Springs, and it was actually established in what had been a former Nazi World War II underground factory for building parts that were, you know, manufactured in a facility that was hidden from you know, U.S. surveillance aircraft and, you know, spies and things. And so the idea that, in fact, there's a program called COG, C-O-G, which means Continuity of Government. And that program is specifically designed to preserve as much of the function of the United States government as possible if there were to be a preemptive strike on the United States by one of the other superpowers like Russia or China. So, you know, I know that those things exist. I've seen plenty of evidence of it. I've never actually been in one of the facilities myself, but I know that they do exist. So,
well, what do you think of the name 2012?
Well, you know, I mean, it certainly suggests that there's more to the Mayan calendar than you know what so many of the new agers and people who've you know written books to try and exploit the mystery of that particular date have had to say. And I mean, you know, I often joke with some of my friends that the whole you know sort of inside joke of the 2012 mystery is that the stone chiselers from the Mayan culture just simply ran out of rock to you know to hammer away their calendars on, and that's when they stopped, was that particular date. So you know it may not have any significance, although I think there have been statements made more recently by the Catholic Church and some insiders in the government that suggest that there is a real concern that this coming solar cycle, where we get these magnetic storms on the sun, that we're going to see some particularly large solar mass ejections. They're anticipating that something like that may happen. Whether or not it will is probably something you'd have to talk to someone who's an expert on the sun about. But I know that years ago, in the 70s and the 80s, that I had seen a number of astronomy textbooks that talked about the sun and talked about the 11 and 22 year sun cycles, sunspot cycles, and that it was mapped out on a graph as a sawtooth wave, which would go up and down, kind of like the teeth of a saw. But that the overall path of that sawtooth wave was escalating and going up on a gradual scale, so that each successive cycle became more and more, you know, active and energetic. So, you know, it may be that the sun has longer periodic, you know, sessions of activity, I guess you would say, that also represent another kind of sawtooth wave where it ramps up over many, many years of, you know, various cycles to kind of a crescendo and then drops back down again to even lower levels of activity. And, you know, that may in fact be what we've just been through, because there was about a three-year period where there was no solar activity at all, no storms, no sunspots, nothing. So, and that was really at the first part of what was thought to be a cycle that we were going to see a lot more activity. So, it's hard to say. I mean, I would really suggest talking to somebody who's an expert in the activity of the sun, because I honestly don't know whether we have anything to be afraid of or not.
It was interesting you mentioned HARP before, because mm-hmm. nobody really knows what the purpose of HARP is. They suspect that HARP is a facility that burns off part of the lower part of the atmosphere to send waves out that would be picked up in communications around the world. Other people say it's a weather controlling device. But I don't think there's been any documents that were ever recovered that say exactly what HARP is.
Well, Nick Begich wrote a book a number of years ago, probably about 10 years ago. I think it was called Angels Don't Play This HARP, and of course it's spelled H-A-A-R-P, which I believe means High Altitude Active Aurora Research Program. And for your audience who's not familiar with HARP, what it is would be described as a phased array of antennas, and that simply means that you have a large, flat, contoured area of land, and you've got, say, you know, 1,000 radio broadcast antennas, or antennas that can broadcast radio frequency energy, RF energy, and they're all equally spaced out on a grid. Say, you know, if you put an antenna on each of the corners of a square, and then you had many, many squares all next to one another, so you have this perfectly set up grid. The idea behind a phased array antenna system is that you are able to time precisely the broadcast of any pulse of energy coming from each and every one of those antennas, and it's all done with computers, but imagine, you know, that you have all these antennas, and each one can broadcast a signal that goes out into space in all directions at the speed of light. And so even if you wanted to, say, have the signal from one corner of the array reach a distant location at the exact same moment that the signal from another antenna, completely on the other side of this array, that you wanted those two signals to arrive at the same moment in time, you'd have to have a perfectly timed mechanism for turning one of those antennas on and turning it off again, and then timing the transmission of the other antenna so that both signals arrive at the same location simultaneously. So imagine, of course, that you have all these antennas set up so that they can each be turned on and turned off at a precise moment. And then what you do is you phase the broadcast from each of those antennas so that as you cascade across the entire array of antennas, each one broadcasts at a precise fraction of a second apart from the other, so that every one of those signals, say, 50,000 watts apiece from 1,000 antennas, and you wind up with, what, 5 billion watts of energy all arriving at the exact same spot in space and time at exactly the same moment. And what happens when you do that is that you're able to saturate a given area with a tremendous amount of energy by combining and overlapping all of these signals at the exact same moment. Now, when you do that, and believe me, it is possible to do this, but when you accomplish that, you pump a tremendous amount of energy into the environment. I mean, and if you could time it precisely enough, you could pick out an individual person by using the GPS locator in their cell phone. You could literally vaporize a human being using a system like this. So if you broadcast from all of these antennas, at the same time, you could fry the electronics in a flying aircraft and bring it down, which makes it a weapon system. Or you could do a more general broadcast into, say, an area of, you know, 2 or 3 square miles, and actually do a tremendous amount of heating of the atmosphere. Now, this is what I think may have happened with all these blackbirds and things that came falling out of the sky here a few weeks ago. Let's say you want to manipulate the path of the jet stream, which carries a lot of the weather patterns across the United States. It changes seasonally, sometimes diverting further north and bringing cold winds down from the north, the polar regions, and sometimes bringing winds down from the Antarctic. But let's say you want to steer that mechanism by creating high and low pressure systems. Low pressure systems are usually systems where the air rises suddenly, producing a low pressure area, and the warm, moist air goes to a higher altitude where it's much colder, and when that happens, the moisture that's in the air condenses into clouds and then forms a storm system. High-pressure areas are where the air is colder and it's coming down onto the earth and producing higher barometric pressure. So let's say you wanted to use this effect of pumping energy into the atmosphere, you can cause, you can achieve this, rising and falling of the massive areas of the atmosphere by using heating and convection effects like the air that rises above the heat from a candle. By heating the ionosphere above a given area, it'll actually rise higher out into space, and when it does that, it'll pull a part of the atmosphere up with it. And it could cause a very sudden rising of masses of air. Now, this is actually how hailstorms form. A lot of people don't realize that when you get a tremendous updraft, like the kind that can be produced in powerful storm systems, the air rises so quickly that droplets of water are carried to much higher altitudes very quickly, and they freeze instantly. Sometimes they'll start to fall back down again, and they'll get caught in the updraft, and they'll be drawn as hailstones, small hailstones, maybe an eighth of an inch across, and be drawn back up into higher altitudes again. And this can happen in multiple cycles over a number of hours, so that these little beads, these little nuclei of ice can form many, many layers. In some instances, there have been cases where there have been hailstorms in Europe with hailstones that came down the size of golf balls or even baseballs. And, of course, they're very, they can be very dangerous. There's been millions of dollars in damage done to, vehicles and parking lots at dealerships, windows broken, people actually injured from these kinds of things. But, this can happen over and over again. And if you happen to have a flock of blackbirds that are flying through the area, say at 500-600 feet off the ground or higher, and they get pulled up into one of these updrafts, very often these birds can be lofted to altitudes 20,000-30,000 feet where they freeze solid, and then they start to fall back down to earth like hailstones. And of course the freezing process ruptures the cellular structure inside their bodies, and so by the time they get back down the ground, because birds having feathers and so forth tend to fall a lot slower than hailstones would, by the time they get back down to the ground, they're thawed, and all their internal organs are completely hemorrhaging and turned to mush.
Well, let me stop you right there, if I may. Let me see if I have this right. When you're talking about the birds, I get the feeling that you really don't feel that the fish kills were connected to the bird kills.
Well, I think the fish kills, there's probably a dozen different things that could cause large numbers of fish to die. I don't think it was a virus, because having that many fish die all at once certainly suggests something more along the lines of an unpredicted and uncontrolled release of toxins of one kind or another into the water.
Well, if that was the case, why was it that only drumfish died?
Well, that's a good question. I had heard that. I don't know if it's true, but there are certain fish that feed on certain parts of the environment. I don't know anything about drumfish, so I can't tell you whether they're like catfish or, triggerfish or...
Well, they're bottom feeders. They're bottom feeders.
Bottom feeders...
They eat mollusks, and they eat different things in the bottom of the sea,
Well, many years ago, I had a collection of books I think was originally produced by the Disney Company, and one of the things that always stuck with me that I learned from that was that you could have certain organisms in the environment that will eat toxins, that will, absorb or eat toxins as part of their diet, and they might be eaten by slightly larger fish who in turn are eaten by other fish that, may pass these kinds of components through their digestive systems and not be harmed by it. But along comes a much larger fish who's very sensitive to certain toxins that are already in the bodies of these other fish who ate that original small invertebrate or what it might, you know, what have you. And they very quickly perish because as their body tries to process these toxins, it kills them. And so I think that if you have a very specific species of fish that's dying in mass, it may be that there were other bottom-feeding organisms that were exposed to some kinds of toxins, maybe heavy metal pollution, mercury, or something of that kind, and that it worked its way up through the food chain, and that as a school of these particular fish came through the area, they may have actually encountered organisms that already had the toxins in their system, or they may have been exposed to toxins that were very specific to wherever it is they feed. So if they're bottom feeders and you're talking about heavy metals, which in a slow-moving stream like the Arkansas River would tend to hug the bottom of the watery environment, it may be that that's exactly what it was, is some kind of a toxin that got into the water system.
So basically you feel it was a coincidence that the fish died at the same time as the birds?
Well, yeah. It may be a coincidence. It doesn't seem to me like it would be. I know we mentioned Sorcha Fall earlier, but one of the allegations that was made on that website was that this area where the drumfish died wasn't too far from the Pine Bluff Army chemical weapon arsenal.
Well, that part is true, but, you know, there's been more drumfish dying in other places.
Well, then in that case, I would have to say that it may be something that's specific to the species and not so much the environment.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem as though you would have a specific species like that without members of some of the other neighboring species of fish dying, if there was some specific toxin in the environment that that they were vulnerable to. One of the things that I think has been mentioned several times since the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico was that many people were worried that the water that evaporates in the Gulf of Mexico is heavily laden with toxins like this Corexit dispersant that they were using down there, and that it actually got into some of the water that was rising up in clouds that form over the Gulf of Mexico, and then when it circulates back over land and falls as rain, that rain then in turn gets into the water system and brings these toxins into places where organisms like the drumfish that ordinarily wouldn't see these kinds of toxins are suddenly right. exposed to high levels, and that it kills them. So, I mean, you can imagine any number of different scenarios where these kinds of eventualities may take place as a matter of natural weather patterns carrying toxins from one region to another. So,
getting back to HAARP, are you aware that there is a theory that if enough energy can be applied to a certain small enough area in space that it might be possible to break through to another universe or dimension?
Well, I would have to imagine. I don't doubt that that's possible, and I only say this because I've seen events that certainly suggest it is possible. But whether or not you could do that with an array of 50 or 100 or even 1,000 antenna all broadcasting, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of watts of energy, I'm not really sure that you would be able to break into another dimension. I think that it's possible to concentrate enough energy in a location that you can cause a distortion in space-time, but whether or not you'd be able to break through to another dimension, I just don't know.
Ben Rich was the second person to be put in charge of the Lockheed Skunk Works, the ultra-secret aircraft and probably spacecraft building facility. He stated on his deathbed over 15 years ago that we were in possession of technology that could change the world, but it was being kept secret. He also said we had the technology to reach the stars and could take E.T. home. What do you think about all that? Do you think that he was irrational when he was dying, or that we actually have this?
Well, a number of years ago, I did do some work for Lockheed, and I did some work specifically for Skunk Works. And I can tell you unequivocally that those kinds of technologies do exist. I've seen activity and manifestations of that technology on several dozen occasions. And I think that, you know, if you know where to hang out at, in different times of the evening or the wee hours of the morning, and you're very observant, that just about anybody else could see these things too. And, you know, I've had the benefit of, you know, making the acquaintance of many people in the defense industry, and of course many of us are interested in these kinds of topics, and so over time, you begin to hear from other individuals where and when you may may visit a particular location to see things of that nature, and I've found, much to my surprise, on many occasions that these suggestions had a lot of weight to them, and that in fact I did see things that were just remarkable, so I have no doubt that there was a lot more to Ben Rich's statement than just mere talk.
Well, that was, roughly about 15 years ago. If that was true, it would be very interesting to see where we are today, right? Because if we could do that 15 years ago, imagine what we might be able to do today.
Well, I can tell you that... and this kind of goes back to the whole idea of underground bases and so forth, that there is a tremendous amount of advanced technology that's being used, and I cannot say for certain whether that's being used expressly by the U.S. military or by some agency like the National Reconnaissance Office or the NSA or a Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, but I can tell you that someone is using some extremely advanced technology, and very often right under our noses in areas sometimes right within the city limits of major metropolitan areas, sometimes right on the outskirts of metropolitan areas. Los Angeles is a perfect example. There's a lot of things going on there with NASA and United States Air Force has a base, I think it's called Los Angeles Air Force Base, right in the heart of the city, and it controls an awful lot of what happens with some of our surveillance satellites. I mean, you should see the roof of some of these buildings. They're bristling with antennas of every imaginable kind, and so there's an awful lot of intelligence gathering that goes on, and certainly if you have a platform that can move from one spot to another at incredible speeds, it greatly augments your ability to gather intelligence on what other countries and other governments are doing around the world. So you can see why technology of that kind might be kept under wraps, because it represents a real strategic advantage for governments to be able to get from one place to another in an extremely short amount of time. Essentially, the faster you can get from one place to another, you know, if you're the first one on the site, you can be the first one to lay claim to perhaps a spacecraft that comes from another star system. But it also means that you can preempt a preemptive strike from some other country. If you can see with your satellites that China's fueling all their ICBMs, their intercontinental ballistic missiles, and you have a weapon system that can be in that neighborhood in under 5 minutes, and we do, then you can certainly use that to your advantage. You can use it as a deterrent. You can use it to intimidate. You can use it to let the other side know that if they make the mistake of, you know, trying to perpetrate a preemptive launch against the United States, that they're going to pay dearly. And there's some evidence that that's exactly what happened in the past with North Korea and some of its ballistic missile tests, you know, in the Western Pacific. You know, so it certainly represents an advantage for whoever possesses the technology.
Supposedly, Val Thor was a man that looked human, but it's claimed that he came out of a spacecraft that landed near the Pentagon and was brought to the Pentagon by police. Have you ever heard of him, and do you believe that he came from Venus and that it could be populated inside?
Well, I've heard bits and pieces of the Val Thor story. I honestly don't know whether it's true. I'm a little skeptical, there's there have been a few theories that a massive object passed through the solar system many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years ago, and really upset the balance of the arrangement of our solar system, that it may have been responsible for taking and actually tipping the axis of either Neptune or Uranus over on its side, where it's basically, orbiting the sun, rolling around on its side rather than spinning on an axis similar to the Earth. But it's entirely possible that planets like Venus, which is almost identical in size to the Earth, that it may have been thrown into an orbital position closer to the sun, which made its surface uninhabitable. But may have also, if you had a technologically advanced society that was already on the planet before this happened, it may entirely be possible that that they moved deep underground. Naturally, of course, you can only go so deep into the Earth's, or any planet's crust for that matter, before you start encountering higher temperatures as a consequence of getting closer and closer to the molten mantle of the planet. So, it would have to be some middle of the road region in the ground that would allow you to be able to do something like that. So,
I guess you don't subscribe to the hollow Earth theory, then.
No,
the hollow planet theory.
No. I'm sure that. I'm sure that there are some people that really believe that those kinds of things may be possible. And personally, I think that, it may be possible that there's a civilization that exploits the powerful, relatively powerful magnetic fields in the polar regions of a planet to augment whatever, time and space distortion technologies they may already have. I remember this story from, it was Admiral Byrd, or one of the famous explorers, who claimed that they traveled up to the North Pole and they eventually seemed to go into a huge depression that eventually...
That was Admiral Byrd, yeah.
Yeah. It's a fantastic story. I don't think that anybody's ever really produced a movie about, what it was that he saw, but I found it... kind of strange and coincidental that all the people that he encountered had German accents. So maybe he just crossed over the pole and he came down in Scandinavia or Poland or Germany or somewhere and didn't realize it.
Well, there's this old story going around, that after World War II, a lot of the Germans fled to a secret base they had at the poles. Let's see.
I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah, and the story with Byrd was that, this is what people say, of course there's no proof, that when he found this place, he found pieces of equipment that were abandoned and different things. Some of them had swastikas on them and things like that,
Yeah.
There seems to be more talk lately about another dimension that's an energy dimension. It's said that it can be tapped for unending energy. Have you ever heard about this, and what do you think about it? And if you believe that it's true, do you think that maybe the ancients somehow were able to tap into this source of energy to move some of these huge stones in their construction?
Well, that's kind of a multi-layered question.
Yeah, it is.
And to answer that, I would have to say yes, yes, and yes. But yes, yes, I have heard of the idea that there may be multiple dimensions, and I do believe that they exist, and yes, I think it may be possible that they were able at some point to tap into that energy. To go into a little bit more specific detail. you know, back around the end of the 19th century, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when Nikola Tesla and a number of other scientists were experimenting with cryogenic fluids, taking gases like nitrogen and oxygen and argon and compressing them through a sort of a cycling system that would compress the gases more and more and more to the point where they would actually condense into liquids, supercooled liquids that were, you know, hundreds of degrees below zero. They began to search for that temperature that might be described as absolute zero. And really, when you look at the world that we live in, there's a tremendous amount of heat, even in the polar regions. There's always a certain amount of latent heat that's stored in everything, and it's stored in the form of what is called Brownian motion. That's where the molecules are vibrating and moving because of heat that's absorbed and carried in the substances in the environment. Now, what these scientists were trying to do was trying to find a point at which all of that movement relating to heat, all of that Brownian motion, would come to a stop, and everything in the vicinity of that extremely cold temperature would suddenly become solid. Even you know, the gases like oxygen and nitrogen would turn to a solid form, and there would be absolutely no heat whatsoever. But what they found in the process was that even in the circumstance where you would cool something down to a temperature that was approaching this so-called absolute zero, that there was still this electrical flux, this electrical charge that would stay in the environment and would continue to make the molecules and the atoms jiggle. The term that I think Max Planck, the great German physicist, used was Zitterbewegung, which means jiggle in German. And so they began to try and figure out what this energy was. And so they called it zero-point energy because it was an energy that you could really only see clearly some evidence of as you were approaching absolute zero, so where there wasn't all these other energetic phenomenon that were occurring in the material that would hide the presence of this particular kind of energy. That's kind of where the name zero-point energy came from. So they began trying to figure out what it was about this energy that was unique. Tesla referred to this energy as longitudinal waves. Other people have made reference to it as cyclotronic energy or scalar energy. And there's a lot of different opinions about what it is exactly, except that it seems to just materialize right out of the fabric of space-time. It's almost as though the energy itself is embedded in the fabric of space-time itself, that it's there, it's sort of hidden. Some scientists actually use terms that sound like something out of science fiction, that it's a kind of energy that's actually has a material existence in another parallel dimension, and that as it begins to sort of ortho-rotate into our dimension, it goes from being something like a photon, which is a particle that has no mass, and as it comes a little bit more into our dimension, it actually begins to manifest not as a photon but as an electron, and then when it actually comes into our environment, that it actually can be absorbed by the material structure, the atomic structure of all the matter in our universe, and that's in fact what keeps the universe in motion. Now, if you could, you know, shrink yourself down to the size of an atom and look at the structure of an atom, you might think to yourself that you're looking at a structure that's an awful lot like the solar system, where you have the nucleus in the middle of every atom that looks like the sun, which is actually comprised of protons and neutrons, which are all in motion, are very energetic, but they're very localized in the center of the atomic structure. And then around that you have all these little electrons that are orbiting just like planets. And when you get into materials that are heavier and heavier, like uranium, you may have multiple shells in which you have, 12 or 20 different electrons all orbiting in this one particular region as you go further and further away from the nucleus. And this is what gives each of these elements in the periodic table their mass, their atomic weight, if you will. And so one of the things that many people learned about in chemistry and physics in high school was that you have these different laws of thermodynamics where anything that's, you know, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, and for every thing that's in motion it tends to stay in motion unless there are, you know, forces in the environment that will slow it down or cause any kind of energetic activity to slow down and eventually stop because of what is called entropy, where you have the dissipation of energy into the environment, which causes things to sort of slow down and move into a state of equilibrium. And this is kind of why zero-point energy is difficult to detect, because it tends to be in equilibrium. It's equally distributed through the environment, like the fog, the little droplets of water that you see as you're moving through the fog. Now, but if you look at the actual structure of the atom, it seems to be a violation of the very things that we say cannot happen in nature, and that is, you know, perpetual motion, a machine that can lift itself up by its own bootstraps, or run continuously and never stop because there's always some energy in the system that feeds back upon itself. Well, as it turns out, matter itself is really like the perfect example of a perpetual motion machine. It's kind of a violation of entropy because it always is moving. The electrons are always spinning around the nucleus of the atom, and they never slow down. And eventually became evident to these scientists that this energy that's embedded in space-time is the very reason that all of these subatomic particles, like the electrons, protons, neutrons, and all the little particles that make them what they are, they're all absorbing this energy right out of the fabric of space-time, and that's what keeps them in motion all the time. And so if you can then control the flow of that energy, you can control things at the atomic scale. And so if you're able to do that, then you can affect the mass of an object. If you can use electricity and sound and other things to affect the rate at which that energy is being absorbed by the atomic structure of, say, big blocks of stone, you can take those stones and make them as light as a feather and move them around just by pushing them with your fingertip. So this is something that I think that the ancients figured out. Over time, I think that if you look at some of the carvings inside the tombs in Egypt, you can certainly see a lot of things there that suggest that they had a handle, in some of the mystery schools and some of the schools of magic that you occasionally hear about in these ancient cultures. There were probably wise men, what we would call scientists today, who were, you know, tinkering with these things, trying to figure out what lightning is, for example, or trying to figure out what ball lightning is when, you know, lightning hits the ground that is very high in quartz-bearing material, that it produces this self-sustaining phenomenon that looks like a ball of plasma floating around in the environment that seems to persist of its own accord for some period of time. So,
have you ever heard, this is rather ghoulish what I'm going to say, but this theory is out there, that when people die and animals die and plants die, they release energy, and the energy they release is what is being picked up by these supposedly these forms of energy that they think they're getting from another dimension.
Well, I think that there may be something to that. I mean, one of the things that I've always been interested in since I was a little kid was parapsychology and haunting and poltergeist activity, and I've had some direct experience with those kinds of things, and if it suggested anything to me at all, it seemed to prove to me, to my own satisfaction, that there are multiple dimensions, and in fact the environment that many people, Christians, think of as heaven may in fact be another dimension that our consciousness goes to when our physical bodies die. It may be that our spirit is actually kind of sentient, energetic intelligence that occupies our physical bodies while we are in this environment. It's the one thing that allows us to manifest our will in this environment, and that when the you know the organization of cells that we call our bodies becomes defective or is physically harmed by events that occur in this dimension, it can no longer sustain a living organism that our spirit could occupy. So it may be that you know that energy you speak of is a real thing. I don't really know that anybody has actually devised a mechanism that can detect this particular life energy, if you will, although there are a lot of sensitives, psychics and clairvoyants and things, people who claim that they are able to see and feel and detect the presence of this residual energy after an individual has died or even years after people have passed over, so to speak. So, you know, having experienced the things that I've done, I've seen things that have moved on their own without the physical input, you know, from anyone in the area. I've experienced in one hotel back on the East Coast, out in the very old town of Provincetown, Massachusetts, way out on the tip of Cape Cod. I had occasion to spend several nights in a hotel there that was reputed to be haunted, and it was managed by an uncle of mine and his girlfriend. And I was laying in bed wide awake and had some manifestation occur in that room. It was so powerful that it actually pressed my body down into a mattress, to the point where you can no longer see the impression of my feet and my legs in the covers on the bed. I mean, it was an absolutely terrifying experience. I mean, and it certainly wasn't a night terror or, you know, night paralysis. This was a physical manifestation that, I mean, it felt as though my body was being pressed under a giant plate of lead and being basically forced down in the mattress. And although there was no physical harm that occurred to me personally, the paralysis was so complete and so uniform in its application that it felt as though my entire body had turned to a giant ingot of lead and was actually being pressed down into the body as a matter of its own weight. It was, but you know, here again, something like that might be expressed as a kind of energy that's in the environment that actually increased the mass of my body to many times its normal density. And that, you know, I mean, people often overlook the fact that when Einstein talked about, you know, his equation, E equals mc squared, it was showing an equivalence between a certain amount of mass or activity that's occurring in a mass of an object and the amount of energy that it would take to be equivalent to that mass. This is where nuclear power comes from, is converting, you know, the mass of an object into energy, into pure energy, through a fusion or fission reaction. So if you're able to increase the density of energy in an environment, just like, you know, what we talked about earlier in the case of HARP, if you're able to increase the density of energy in a given region, you know, many, many orders over the normal, you can, in fact, you know, cause a distortion in space-time to some degree or another.